Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com, where we take you down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be, with conversations from those who paved the way. And now the GWH Radio Network presents Peach State Pandemonium.
Good evening and welcome to Peach State Pandemonium for Thursday, August 15th, 2013. Can you guys believe it's August already, the middle of August already? I can't believe how fast this has gone.
I put my Christmas list in the mail to you guys today.
Well, hopefully it'll get here after I'm gone, so I'll have an excuse. Your Christmas gift may be having me live with you for the entire month of December.
Yeah, I heard that.
That'll be a gift. Wouldn't
it? Oh, man. Well, how are you guys? Well, welcome back, Bobby. How did the Falcons do last week?
Well, when the first team was in there, we did okay. And I'm talking to you and got one eye on the TV, and we're up 3-0 tonight. So we're, you know, it. We'll see.
Who are they playing this week?
Playing Baltimore tonight.
Okay. Oh, man. I haven't followed football so long I couldn't tell you who was what. Except the year the Saints went all the way. I kind of followed them starting about mid-season when it looked like they may do something. I followed the Falcons a little bit last year, but I knew Bobby had them covered for us, so.
Well, that's where that's where the Falcons open up this year. Opening weekend, we're in New Orleans.
Really?
Yep.
There's going to be some surprising teams out there this year.
I think so, too.
I really do.
Well, they need to kind of shuffle the deck a little bit to make it interesting. Same teams all the time being so dominant. There really hadn't been any dominant dynasties like there were back in the 70s. And with Pittsburgh and Dallas and teams like that. But who do you follow, Jerry? Are you a Jaguars fan, you're so close to
it? I don't have just one particular team.
Okay.
I can't get into that. I mean, I like the Colts. I've always liked Denver. I've always liked them, but, I mean, I'm not a rah-rah man for anybody.
You don't have – well, you never – I guess when you were in Columbus all those years, Atlanta was the closest to a hometown team for you. That's the way it was with me growing up in Mobile. New Orleans was the closest, and then I kind of switched to Atlanta when I moved to Atlanta.
I followed the Falcons to, you know, Novus got beat to death up there. Being the only player they had, then I lost interest in them.
And Bobby, I guess you've always been a Falcons fan. When did they start there? 66?
66. My uncle bought season tickets in 1966, and he put them in my name. I was 11 years old. And I've had them ever since.
Well, Bobby, they ought to give you a set of season tickets.
I tell them that too. Every year I tell them that.
Kind of like frequent flyer miles or something.
Jeez.
That's what I'm trying to tell you.
Man, I have been out there where it was so cold and raining at that old stadium, and there wouldn't be 20,000 people out there, and I'd be sitting out there just like I had good sense. I'm a football fan. I've got season tickets to them, season tickets to Georgia Tech. That's my fall. That's my therapy.
That's one of the coldest I've ever been was at Atlanta Fulton County Stadium. I went up to see the Falcons play the Dallas Cowboys. I had to leave for the fourth quarter. I thought I was going to freeze to death.
It's cold. You know, it's a shame it took me years and years to learn how to go to a football game. You know, if you can keep your feet warm, you can keep the rest of you warm. But if your feet ever get cold, son, you are sunk.
Yeah, you're done.
Yeah, I mean that's just. But yeah, it was the dome's nice, but football's made to be played outside. So I just, when they build this new stadium, if they build it, of course, I don't know if I'll be going after they build the new one, because they're talking about putting that personal seat license on the seats, and if they do that, then Bobby won't be going.
They gonna put what to it?
The trend with these cities that are building these new stadiums, they call it a PSL, which is a personal seat license. The New York Giants has it. The New York Jets have it. Denver has it. A lot of these cities have this. And what you do, you have to buy a license from the city or whoever owns the stadium for the right to buy the seats. So you may have to pay $2,000 for a personal seat license, and then still have to pay the Falcons for the season ticket for that seat.
Come on, Bobby.
I'm telling you the truth if I've ever told it, sir. And they're talking about that. Well, now, originally they said they wasn't going to do it in the upper deck, which is where my seats are. I sit in the upper deck by choice because I go to watch a football game, and you can see better up there. But, now they say they may do it with all of them. If they do that, I won't be going. I'm not. That's just.
That's almost like stealing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Exactly.
James at least had the courtesy to pull a gun on you. They just, they do it with a pencil.
They learned that from the Alabama Boxing and Wrestling Commission charging $15 a year for a license.
Jeez. Listen, they've started that commission back up.
Yep.
They have started that back up over there. But anyway, going back to the Georgia Tech, I've had Georgia Tech season tickets for 27, 28, no, maybe 30 years. I've had them a long time. I had seats on a 50-yard line in the upper deck right behind the Georgia Tech bench. And when they increased the size of the stadium and they built the upper deck on the end, of course, they had to figure out a way to pay for it. So they sent me this real nice letter and said that unless I contributed $1,000 a year to the scholarship fund, I wasn't going to be able to keep those seats. I was going to have to move to the end zone. So,
oh, come on.
Sure did. So I told him, I said, move me. So my seats went from the 50-yard line to the end zone. But with this offense that they run out at Tech with that flying wedge or whatever you call it, they're actually great seats because you can see the plays open up. But, they find some way to, I told the guy at Georgia Tech, I said, look, right now y'all are winning some games. And I said, people are coming. I said, but it won't be too long. It'll be like it was when I first started coming out here and there was 25,000 of us. You will appreciate people like me.
It's amazing.
It's all big business.
Yes. University of Georgia, you got to spend big bucks to get them tickets. You got to donate all sorts of money to get good seats at Georgia.
Well, I'm sure.
I don't care what they say. It's all professional. I mean, they pay those college players, regardless of how they get around it. They pay them some way or another.
They have to.
And they're not there for the education because most of them come out, they go to the NFL, they break a leg or something, can't play anymore. They don't have any education, so they do nothing.
When I worked for Barnett had season tickets right behind the Georgia bench. He was about 12 rows up on the 50-yard line. He was sitting right in the middle of George Busby and Joe Frank Harris and all these former governors and current governors, and all of them sat right there together. And there was a linebacker at Georgia during the probably 1978, 79, 80, 81, 82 season, right along in there somewhere. We paid for his car. He had a leased car he drove, and we paid for it.
Oh, sure.
I ain't real sure how that deal worked, but I know I made that lease payment every month.
And they put it in their parents' name. They buy their parents a house. So it's, I don't know.
Well, we ran a show in Wrightsville, Georgia, when Herschel Walker was a junior down there. And, we had heard about him and, about how good he was and all this stuff about him. And when we were down there, the coach, we asked about him, and the coach was telling us about him. And when we went to eat supper, one of the coaches went with us and showed us where Herschel lived. And it was just a little house, side of the road, nothing special about it. We ran a spot show there a few years later after Herschel went to Georgia. And I asked them if they still lived out there, and they go, oh, no. So they got a big, nice house on the other side of town now. You know, where you figure that came from.
Well, it worked. I've heard, always heard it said, the college football is nothing but minor league for the NFL. That's all it is. They, you know, they get these people scholarships and they can't read. I went to high school with a guy that ended up getting a scholarship to Auburn. And he was in English class with me. He couldn't read, write, or anything else. But they passed him along because he was a great football player. And wound up going to Auburn and got hurt. And I guess he wound up back in Mobile, you know, washing cars or whatever. But I don't know. It's all a mess. Before we go any further, I just want to give you guys an update on Bill Bowman. He is still not home, but he is in a, as Charlotte Smith called it, a nursing home, but it's actually a rehabilitation center. And I called to check on him yesterday, and he was talking to the doctor, so his son Brian answered the phone and said he was doing okay, and, you know, they just want to, you know, make sure that they get him through whatever it is to get the fluid off of his heart. And he had some sort of problem with one of his feet. And I don't know if that was due to circulation or he's a diabetic as well, whether it's part of that or what it is. But hopefully he'll be home sometime next week. But I'll keep everybody informed and let you know as things progress. And just, if Charlie Smith calls you and tells you something, don't believe it. Just,
I heard
he's
that.
Gotten it wrong. He's gotten it wrong. So, oh, man. But what I wanted to talk about this week, what we were going to talk about the last time all three of us were together and had the CIA shut down our show for some reason, was for the NSA, this FBI, or somebody. But I just wanted to talk about... Talk about the various fans. I know you guys, especially Jerry, work traveling from so many different territories. So I'll start with you, Jerry. Were the fans different at different locations? I mean, did they expect more? Did they react to different things in the various territories you worked at? Or did you even
Not
pay
really.
Attention to them?
Not really. I found that they were, you know, basically the same everywhere. You know, you had a lot of fans more enthusiastic than others, no matter where you went. But I think every town had always had one or two that stood out, like Miss Young in Macon with her cane and whistle. Bobby remembers her. I guess one of the greatest fans I've ever seen. And, of course, I'm not just saying because I'm from Columbus, was a merry bunch.
Yep.
I mean, if those doors opened, she was there. I mean, rain or shine, no matter what. I don't guess she ever missed a match, did she, Bobby?
Not that I know of. Not that I know of. The first car I ever bought, I bought from Mary Bunch. It was her husband's, and when he died, she parked it in the driveway. It was a 1962 Mercury Meteor, and I was 17, and I'd never bought a car, and I was looking for something. She said, "Let's have it for $175," so I bought it.
Oh, come on!
Sure did. I drove it for about a year, and then it decided to let me down one night coming up 16 out of Statesboro one Friday night.
But,
yeah, Mary was Mary. Actually, when me and my first wife got married, Mary gave us our reception.
Did she really?
Yes, she was. She was her and my first wife's mother were big friends, and
she was a great lady.
She was super lady. As a matter of fact, when Mary died, all her wrestling programs and all her books and all the stuff she had collected all over those years. Her daughter called me, and I went down there and got all of them. And I
they
went
had
through
been a slew of them, Bobby.
There was, but the problem was that when she had gotten sick, they had put them outside in a storage bin, and most of them were not salvageable. It was a gold mine of stuff there, and most of it was ruined because it was put outside and it got wet. And I was able to save a little bit of it, and some of it I gave to Ted Allen because I knew he would take care of it. It didn't really mean anything to me, but it was there was some great stuff there. But yeah, I mean, she had programs. I mean, she always had programs and magazines, and she cooked for the guys. And she was one of those people that if she cooked something and brought it to you, you didn't worry about it. You ate it. You know, just a great lady. Yes, she was.
And she wasn't a pesty fan.
No, no.
You know, some of them were pesty, which I should say. Or pushy, I should say.
Yeah. Remember, do you remember Granny from Carrollton?
Oh, come on.
Had this lady, Mike, that sat on the front row in Carrollton. She was there every week. She had come up and beat on the ring and holler and stick her head under the ropes and scream at you and she,
well, Bobby,
she,
I got no idea how old she was then.
No. She dipped snuff. Generally, it was running down her cheeks, you know, if you'd get all wound up. Maybe a year or two ago, I went over to Carrollton and did some work for a guy that was doing a show over there. I was helping him do some TV stuff. And I had a young man come up to me, and he said, "You don't know me." He said, "But I want to thank you." And I said, "Okay, for what?" He said, "For you being so nice to my grandmother." And I said, "Well, who was your grandmother?" And she says, "It was the one y'all called Granny. It sat on the front row." She, I don't know how old she was either. But she was as loyal as she could be. She was there every week.
But there were fans that, I mean, like, if they sat in Section A, front row, seat number 4, that was their seat forever.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, mm-hmm. It was just, I don't remember in Atlanta if we had any characters like that, did we?
Yeah, there was some there, but they wasn't like they were in other places. They were vocal, but they weren't as animated, I don't think, as they were in a lot of other places.
Did the people in Atlanta, I mean, were their seats like locked in every week?
Yes. Yeah. We had a guy in Atlanta, and I wish Randy is listening, where he'd call in, because Randy used to love this guy. There was a guy sitting on the front row in Atlanta for years. His name was Fred Cannon. And Mr. Cannon was he was an older guy, and he was sort of, senile is not the word. He was, it'll come to me in a minute, but he would watch the, him and Paul Jones had known each other for 100 years, and he would watch the matches, and then every Monday he would come to the arena to pick his tickets up. He'd be there right, you know, between 9 and 10 o'clock every Monday morning. He would come to get his tickets. Well, every week he would come over. He would bring Paul Jones. He would always bring him 2 Miller ponies, the little beers. He would bring him a 6-pack. He'd bring him 2 beers. And then, you know, them little pecan twirls you get in a 6-pack at the grocery store. He'd bring him 2 packs of those, and he always had an envelope with his name on it. And we couldn't wait for him to get up the street because we always wanted to open the envelope to read the letter. And he would give Paul a blow by blow of what happened Friday night and what Paul ought to do to correct the situation.
Did he really?
Oh yeah, it was fun. But it was every week. Every week it was he was there every Monday morning. But he wasn't very animated. You didn't see him raising Cain or anything out there, but he was into it big time.
Well, you guys both passed through Mobile, and I don't know if you ever noticed this guy or not, but there was a guy that, I don't know how far back this guy went, but he was from the first time I started going in 1971, and he was still there through Fuller, at least into the early 80s, had the same seat, whether it was in the big auditorium or in the expo hall, And I don't know what this man's name was. All I ever heard him called was Snuffy. And he sat on the front row. And to be honest with you, I saw the man for almost 10 years, and I couldn't tell you what race he was. I don't know if he was white, black, or just dingy. or had been out in the work, out in the sun or whatever, but he was very, very dark skinned. His skin was like leather, and he was real skinny. He always wore a white shirt with suspenders and baggy gray pants and an old-fashioned, like a gangster hat. And he didn't have any teeth, and he would holler at the heels, and he'd stand up and flex like he had muscles, and he dipped snuff out of – he didn't buy, like, Skoll or none of that stuff. He had the old-fashioned silver canister that he kept his snuff in.
He had shown enough snuff.
he had snuff. But he was there forever. And there was another guy, and again, me being a fan, I didn't know any of their names. I called this guy Mum 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 because he stuttered real bad, and when he got upset at the heels, that's what he'd do. He tries to talk, and he couldn't talk. He said, Mum 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 Mum, hollering at the referee. And he hated Curtis Smith worse than anything in this world. Curtis Smith and Eddie Sullivan. Eddie Sullivan always used to fake like he had something in his trunks, a foreign object in his trunks. And that guy would reach in down his pants to his knees trying to get the referee to upstairs while he's stuttering the whole time trying to tell him he had something in his trunks. He couldn't say trunks. He said trunks. And when Smitty was doing the gimmick with the loaded boot, he tapped that boot, and that guy danced all around the ring, tapping his foot, trying to get the referee.
That tore him up, didn't it?
Yeah. Oh, man. I think every town had the regulars that were just not quite all there. They were as fun to watch as the matches were sometimes.
We had a kid, he was a man. There was a guy over in Carrollton named Billy Frick. And Billy always sat on the back row, or next to the back row by the babyface dressing room. And he would jump up and down and scream, and he would take his belt off and he'd wrap the leather end around his hand so that the buckle was on the other end, and he'd beat the chair with the buckle and scream and yell. And, oh, it was, you know, that's the one that Rocket that night said, I've had enough. You with me? And I said, yeah, let's go. And he went back there, and the guy sat down and wouldn't say nothing. And by the time we got back to the ring, he was up again beating that chair. But it was just
Well, maybe he didn't want to hurt Rocket.
Yeah, I guess. But it was a, and there were some everywhere you went. It didn't matter where you went, you always found one.
At least one.
And in a lot of spot shows, you always had one or two that would ride a bicycle to the matches. You know, they'd come up on their bicycle and it'd have headlights on it and a horn. And, you know, I mean, it was a, God love them. I mean, they put food on our table for a lot of years.
That's true.
I'm not making fun of it, but they were characters. I mean, they were, you know. And you couldn't make this stuff up. This is the way people were. And those people, I mean, they were so into what we did. I mean, they knew everything about us.
That's true. Yeah. Oh. Well, Jerry, let me ask you, what would you say if you had to pick one town that you were absolutely just amazed at the crowd reaction? It didn't even have to be your match, just in general. What town would you say had the most vocal fans?
St. Louis.
Really?
Yes.
At the Keel?
You could snatch a headlock. They would. Columbia, South Carolina was unbelievable.
Really?
Yeah, it was unbelievable. One of the roughest crowds I've ever seen was in Cleveland.
They
were rowdy.
They were known for riots. You ever look on YouTube and see the one the riot with I've mentioned this before, Ox Baker and Ernie Ladd.
That's the fastest I've ever seen Ox Baker move.
Yeah, on his tiptoes.
They were, I mean, they were. Oklahoma City could get, and Tulsa could get a little rowdy.
Where were they working the night that Jack Donovan and Danny Hodge, when they got cut?
I want to say that was Tulsa, but I'm not sure.
It was in Oklahoma. I remember that.
Yeah, it was in Oklahoma. I think it was Tulsa.
Yeah.
Jack ended up with, what, 250-something stitches he needed?
Yeah, it was pretty bad.
He carried that scar for years. From then on, the rest of his life, he had that deep scar on his thigh.
You know,
Bobby, did you ever know of anybody around here to get stabbed in Georgia?
Charlie Smith tells me that there was some people got stabbed at the Larry Bell Auditorium in Marietta. And of course, that's going way back. That's probably I'm not trying to be funny. You started in, what, 70, 71?
70.
This is probably before you even started. I never went to Larry Bell. But they used to run in on Saturday nights. And Charlie tells a story about the Von Bronners, and said one of the Von Bronners was hurt and they had to have Saul Weingroff at work. So they did something. I forget what they did, but Charlie said he told them when they did it, he said, "You're going to have everybody in the building in the ring if you do this." And they said, "Nah, it'll be all right." And they did it. And they said Buddy Fuller, who was one of the big baby faces, said he run down to the ring to help. And they said they cut him about halfway around his torso. But that, you know, I don't remember anybody getting cut.
I don't either. I wrestled in this town, but not in the day when they said it. They said Hogansville was dangerous.
Yeah, I've heard that too. Yeah, Hogansville's where, that's where Blassie bought the new Cadillac and Little Eagle bought the new Cadillac. Neither one of them knew they'd bought the exact same Cadillac. When they found out, Blassie went on TV and said, "You pencil neck geeks, I'm coming to Hoganville in my new Cadillac tonight, and don't you dare touch my new car," and blah, 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 blah. And he rode with somebody else, and Little Eagle drove his down there, and they said they cut the top off and the tires off of it. But I don't know. I mean, you have no idea. I don't know this to be a fact, but I refereed one night at Lakewood Fairgrounds at the indoor arena out there when we were working for Gunkel. And when we did a deal with Thunderbolt, and it was a hot finish. And at the end of the thing, I'm going back to the dressing room, and the cops were around me. And I got back as I went up on a little stage, and behind the curtain, I heard something go pop. And I turned around and stuck my head out to see what was going on, and a cop put his hand in my face and just shoved me. And of course, I didn't know it was a cop doing it, so I got hot and I come up ready to fight. And when I did, the cop standing there, and he goes, "I wouldn't come out here if I was you. This might have been meant for you." And I looked outside, and there was a guy right at the foot of the steps that had been shot with a .22.
You kidding me?
No, he was laying there. He was laying there bleeding. I don't know if it was meant for me or not. I didn't stick around to ask.
Right?
I went on to the dressing room, got my little stuff, and went home. But, you know, that happened right behind me, you know, and I would like to think it wasn't meant for me, but, you know, who knows.
But, you know, I'm really surprised more guys didn't really get sure enough messed up.
Yeah.
You know, Ole,
I know Tony Gonzalez got cut twice. Yeah, Ole was cut, and I know Tony Gonzalez, who was one of the original Mysterious Medics, he got cut twice in Mobile. And it was almost a decade apart. Once was in the early 60s, and the other one was, he'd come in 1970 as a baby face. And he was teaming with Bob Kelly, and he turned on Bob Kelly. And they had a pure riot there. And we got somebody I'm going to bring here on the line with us here that has been in many riots, and especially at Fort Whiting in Mobile, and of course he calls most of them. So let me get Joe Turner on the line with us. Hey Joe, what's up?
How you guys doing?
All right.
You know Turner calls quite a few rats in the dressing room among the boys. Yeah, you were talking about places where the fans were, Michael. You know, Greenville, South Carolina, where Ole got cut. That I refereed a match up there where the main event went a 90-minute draw, and the fans got around the ring and was shaking the ring, and I couldn't get out, and Klondike Bill had to come get me.
When Ole got cut?
And that's where Ole got cut was in Greenville, about an 80-year-old man. He was coming down the aisle, and the guy stumped up. He cut him from just under his Adam's apple all the way to his below his belly button.
But the only thing that saved over then was the nurse there got ice and packed on it.
Yeah.
And that's the only thing that saved him. But then when they got to the hospital, Gene went up there. They had him in the same emergency room, but the only thing separating them was them curtains they pull around the bed. And Gene kept sticking his head in there every time the police wasn't watching and making faces at him like he would jump on him, trying to make him have a heart attack. Yeah.
But I think that the most reactive place I ever saw was the Fort Homer Hessery Armory in Tampa. Those places, especially after Dusty turned babyface, and they would have that place rocking. And by the time Dusty would come out, you know, because the babyfaces, they were up on the mezzanine. And he'd come out there after he'd gotten them just about to stomp a hole in the floor. He'd come out there and raise one hand, and they'd go nuts. And Johnny Valentine, I saw, had the exact opposite. He could get people wanting to kill him just by walking to the ring. Because he'd stop, he'd walk about six or seven steps, and he'd stop and look up in the balconies and just kind of stop and look. And those people were ready to lynch him by the time he got to the ring and hadn't done anything. And that's part of the lost art. No music, no fireworks, just walking to the ring.
Talking about Fort Whiting there, one time we had a ride going back to the dressing room. And we got them big old double doors. The police kept them shut so they could squeeze through the doors and get away from the people. There's one guy that kept on talking about what all he's going to do to us and trying to get a hold to us. And the police just took and shut him in the door with us. So we didn't take out of him, and he wouldn't go down. So finally, I just stopped and looked. The neck was holding him up because we were pounding the hell out of him. And then Billy Hines going to run out there and get up underneath him. He's holding him up with his head so he can punch you from underneath. Looking like a cartoon out there. Weird ride.
It's a
good cartoon. Matt Morales, the one time he's out selling pictures. They were short a guy there, and Speed told him, and they picked each other all the time. He said, "Come on, you old fart, we're going to have to use you. You got your bag?" He said, "Yeah, I got it." He said, "You think you can have a match?" And he said, "I can get every chair in this building in that ring." He said, "Yeah, I bet you can. You get too damn old, you can get up in the ring." He got up there, but it didn't take long. He had every chair that was in that armory up in that ring. Speedy was referee.
Yeah, Chico. I said Chico was a character, especially if he was doing his Cuban assassin gimmick and had flour or whatever it was. Cornmeal.
Rocket said Nick had to use him one night somewhere, and he told him, he said, "Boy, he said, don't you throw that powder and all that stuff out there." And he said, "No, Nick, I won't do that." And Rocket said he had been in the ring about 30 seconds. And he said, "You couldn't see for the cloud where he had thrown it."
Nick got mad at him and wouldn't talk to him. So he kept calling and calling, and Nick wouldn't talk to him. So he disguised his voice. And he said, "I need to speak to Nick Gulas. This is Lupez." He told Nick, he says, You need me to come down and wake up this graveyard. This whole thing is dead. he's a character.
That's true. That is true. Well, Joe, I don't know if you heard, were listening in. I was talking about the people in Mobile. Do you remember the old guy Snuffy that used to sit on the front row? He had to have been there forever.
Yeah, it looked like an old farmer or something.
Yeah, exactly. he poured that stuff in his mouth like he was Popeye eating spinach.
Was he real skinny?
Yeah, that was him.
That's the guy that Billy Hines took a picture of. It was wrestling Trump's own in the championship belt.
No, this was a different guy. That guy did stuff around the office. I know because I've got a copy of that picture, and they wrote on there, Roy Welch or something on it. I've got a copy of that picture, but that's not Snuffy. Snuffy was like I said, I don't know what he was or where he lived or if he lived anyway. He may have been homeless because he always wore the same clothes for at least 10 years, but they were always clean. So who knows?
When he'd get excited, I think he wore overalls, but he'd start flapping them arms, look like he was going to fly. The funniest thing about when Pensacola one time, you remember that outdoor show?
Yeah.
You know, and he got to the ring there, and they had this here big, heavy set black lady. She's always doing a dance and hollering and cussing, turn around patting her butt like kiss my butt, you know. And so we got out of the ring. We got to where we just didn't pay much attention to her. But anyway, she started her routine, and she went over there and patting her butt, and the whole crowd went nuts. And I turned around and asked her, I said, what's everybody going nuts over it for? She said, she ain't got no underwear on. see a lot of things. I saw a girl sitting ringside one time, and you know, back then a lot of people wore dresses and stuff. And I can't remember who done that. I think I know, but I'm not gonna say because I don't think it might not have been him. But anyway, she kept on and cussing and everything else. And anyway, he took a bump through the ropes out there and landed right under her feet and reached up between her dress and smashed her panties off. he left it alone.
Well, Bobby, where was it that the guy pulled the pistol on Rocket, or was attempting to pull the pistol on Rocket?
Well, that was in Carrollton. We went out and the guy running his hand in his Rocket was out on the floor. He was an old man wearing overalls, and he's out on the floor, and he had his grandson with him, I guess, and Rocket got to picking at the old man, and the old man run his hand in his pocket, and when he come out, I seen the pearl handle of a pistol. So I jumped out on the floor, and I told Rocket, I said, get in the ring. Rocket said, I'm going to whoop this. I said, get in the ring now. And he knew just by my tone I was upset, and he jumped in the ring. I told him, I said, old sucker's got a gun. I said, you get in here and leave him alone. So we got through and went in the dressing room, and old guy Horace, it was head of security over there for Mr. Butler, I called him in the dressing room, told him, I said, old man got a gun. I said, we ain't going back out there. I said, there may be 100 guns in this building, but I saw that one. And so he went out there, and Rocket said, it wasn't nothing but a pocket knife. I said, well, okay. And he went out there, and a few minutes later, he come back in the dressing room, and he said, all he had in his pocket was this pocket knife. Rocket said, see, I told you. And I said, look, man, I said, I'm telling you, I know the difference between a knife and a gun. And they went out there, and the old man was sitting on it. He had a 25 automatic with a pearl handle on it. Horace come back in that dressing room, told that little 25 automatic, and the blood went out of Rocket's face. I said, I told you. I said, go on back out there and mouth him, at him a little more.
Is it Shelton in Georgia there where they had that building that sit way back up in the fairground?
Yes, sir. That was the first one. That's the one up there by that lake way downtown, yeah.
Yeah, that's where they pulled a gun on Bill and I and Billy Hines. And you remember that policeman that worked it all the time? He was there.
Uh-huh. Yep.
He had to leave one night because they had a guy behind the sawmill shooting at the helicopter, shot the lights out. And all that, and he said he's talking to me when he got a phone call. He said, "Well, I gotta go," and I said, "Where are you going?" He said, "I gotta go out to sawmill. They shooting them state troopers and police and all, and shot the lights out of the helicopter." And I said, "What are you gonna do?" He said, "I'm the sharpshooter. I'm going to take him out." Well, he left, and about 20-25 minutes later, he showed back up. I said, "I thought you went out to sawmill." He said, "I already took care of that." So anyway, he said, one night, Bill and I was walking out to the car, and when we went out the front door, we turned left, and most all the cars were gone. And I've got three, four, five guys standing out there talking a bunch. And Billy Hines and Bill was walking ahead of me about 7-8 feet or better. And I'm walking around in my suitcase, and in Georgia, I always carried a gun in my belt because a lot of the guys in Georgia didn't carry knives. They carried guns. So anyway, that guy stepped out from the crowd and started shooting at me. I put my bag in my belt to get my pistol, and I grabbed his belly because I didn't have my pistol with me. And that policeman come out of there, and he took that big old pistol he had, not from the magazine thing, but he started beating that guy, beating so bad blood to shoot way up in the air with above that pistol. You know, there's a lot of guys carry guns and matches down there in Georgia. I think it was in Kentucky one time, in Hazard, Kentucky, and up in this balcony, and I believe it was Dickie Steinborn was out in the ring. Because it's in, anyway, this guy in the balcony had a coat on, and he's hollering and screaming. And, anyway, he's jumping around there, and you can see he had a shoulder holster on and a pistol. I believe it was Dickie who done it, best of my memory serves me, but Dickie jumped out of the ring and told the police from the ringside, he said, "Hey, that guy up there's got a gun." He said, "Where at?" He pointed. He says, "Oh, that's Jimmy or something like that." And he says, "If he wanted to shoot you, he would have already done it."
Jerry, were you ever involved in any riots anywhere?
In Tulsa one night. Well, in fact, it was a Sunday afternoon. It was Ramey and the interns.
Okay.
Fill the ring up with chairs. Of course, I'm the only one that got hit with one. Hit me right across my shin. He folded that chair up like a frisbee and threw it between the bottom and the second rope and hit me right across the shins. I went straight down. They could get rowdy out there.
Them chairs hurt. When they throw a chair, what you always do is grab one of the chairs up when they're coming in the ring, using that to block the ref because you can't run chairs.
You got your own shield, right?
Yeah. Robert Monroe, who was with him, was out in the ring one night in Panama City, and they had these boys that the family of them, and they're so bad that they actually got mad at one guy and rode up on the side of him on the motorcycle and shot him a bunch of times. And they were pretty bad, but they were coming in the ring with Rocket, and, you know, we used to help each other out if he was good, you know, if we got in a spot. And we get up there and grabbed him chair, and I think Rocket, well, one of the guys broke his arm when he was holding the rope trying to pull up there with a knife in his hand. had a big free-for-all, and McGuire went and told the deputy sheriff, says, man, y'all get paid to stop this stuff. Do something. And they said, oh, we just all do it. We have to call in.
That building you're talking about, Joe, that in Carrollton, what was that, in the middle of that field?
Yeah.
That's the one I was refereeing in the opening match or the second match one night, and the power went out over there.
Yeah.
And old Mr. Butler was the promoter. He owned about half that county. And he didn't have no emergency lighting or nothing in there. When the power went out, it was dark. Well, as soon as I realized it wasn't coming right back on, it was out. I crawled out. I just kind of stooped. I didn't even go out the normal way. I stooped down like the women do and went between the bottom and the middle rope. I jumped right down on the floor and got under the ring. And I mean, it was dark. You couldn't see your hand in front of your face. And all of a sudden, I started hearing something go pow, 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 pow. And I didn't have a clue what it was. A few minutes later, Mr. Butler come down through there, and he had a Coleman lantern. And he walked down there by that ring. He come down by ringside. And when he got down there where I could see the light, I stuck my head out from under the ring. And when I realized what it was, I come out under the ring. I looked up in the ring, and the ring was full of chairs. And I can't remember who the two other guys were in the ring, but they had got out of the ring and got under the ring too. And none of us knew none of the other was under there. If we'd have bumped into each other, that'd have been the darndest fight you ever seen out of that ring. We didn't have a clue what the other two were. I mean, nobody knew. We just got out and did it.
Another thing happened there with Tom Ernesto and I was standing outside the dressing room door. And they had this old boy, he's always acting up over there. And he had some black and white shoes on, them old tights. And so Ernesto says, watch this. And he started staring at that boy's feet. And then he says, he turned around like he's telling me something. He said, laugh, Joe. And I started laughing. He'd laugh. He turned around and looked again and pointed at him. He had that boy so mad that I believe he could have whipped half of us. He's real good at ribs.
Oh, geez. That building, did you ever work that building, Jerry, over in Carrollton? The one by the lake, the one way back in the field? I know you did.
I have lung cancer from working in that building.
Babyface dressing room was about 2.5, maybe 3 feet wide. And had a row of chairs down each side. And when you dressed, you had to put your feet between the two guys' legs on the other side to lace your boots up.
You remember how smoky it got in there?
Oh, yeah. And the ceiling was so low, guys would go out there and try to take backdrops and hit the ceiling.
Hey. We had a place in Bucks, in Mississippi at that TV station when they had them big old, great big bulbs that were so hot.
Yeah.
We were so close to that ceiling, and if you had to stand on the corner underneath one of them, you'd start getting dizzy. You'd be cooking your brain. I forgot about him, and somebody shot me in and gave me a backdrop, and my feet hit some of them lights, and they broke. And they were getting the floor before me, and I'm trying to put on air brakes if they're keeping dancing. This work.
Those
all
fans in Dothan could get rowdy.
Yeah, they could.
They could get rowdy now.
Breathing that red clay on that floor.
I don't know what it was, but I love going to that place.
That's because you never had to work sit in the heel dressing room. It wasn't much better than what Bobby was describing for Carol.
What are you talking about, Dothan?
Dothan.
I don't think that wasn't a hot place, but it was a fun place to wrestle.
Did you ever start any riots there, Joe?
Oh, yeah. We had quite a few. The The thing I liked the best there, though, was Mario Glinto. He horned in on our matches. He got on, walked out on TV and talking about they could put Jerry Graham in a cage. And so Glinto comes out there on his own just to get involved in it and tells him about it. And he wouldn't get out of that cage because I wouldn't be sitting out there with a baseball bat. And so old Graham, he just looked at us and grinned. And he always wore them Tarzan tights. And we was asking Dick Dunn and Don Carson, and we was having quite a fight going on. And Glenn would walk over that cage every once in a while and hit it. Well, we didn't know anything about what was fixing to happen. But Graham then put a wire coat hanger down in that trunk to bed. And then Glenn would come over and turn around and back to it, and he's looking away. He put that coat hanger through them bars, put Glenn Joe around the neck, and he went south with it. And he went south with Dick Dunn. Them they didn't care much for him either for butting in, but they was coming around the ring, both of them, when they seen something happen, saving when they seen what was happening. They was running like crazy. All of a sudden, they just stopped, started walking real slow. Yeah, one time they put me in without a mask on. They set me up in the audience. I was running the match. I was running on the third fall. And I'm sitting up there watching the matches, and the first fall, the guy comes in the concession stand, and he has a drink and stuff in his hands and everything, and all of a sudden he just stops, starts staring at me. Then he started hollering there, but that's the intern. That's the intern. Anyway, I had to take off in the first fall to do what I was going to do. A lot of crazy things happen.
Charlie Harbin told a story. For those, if you never, I mean, of course, Joe and Jerry knew Charlie. Charlie had this very distinctive walk. You know, his back was messed up from all the years, and he had gout. And he had this funny walk. I mean, you didn't have to see his face. If you seen him walking, you knew who it was. And they said that they were somewhere, it might have been Atlanta, and said that somebody didn't show up and they needed Charlie to work. And said they put a mask on him. And he'd come out on the stage, and some kid about 12 years old said, "Charlie Harbin." Said Charlie looked at him and said, "Shut up, kid, you'll give me away."
But nobody else knew who he was.
Yeah,
nobody. Yeah, that happened with Rocket Mobile, I think. They worked some deal where he was going to wear a mask, and Rocket had such a distinct body type, you could tell him from a crowd of 1,000, especially his ankles and calves were so wide. I'm surprised he was able to even tie his boots. But he walked out there with a mask on. Some little kid pointed at him and said, "There's Rocket Monroe."
I might have told y'all this story before, but there's a state representative there. There's a ringside. And he walked in, and anyway, he went over to the wrestling commission office right in behind the Capitol there, and he went over there to the American Legion thing where the commission was, and went through the records to find out about Bill and I's name. And he went to the room and he started calling my real name out. So I just tried to ignore him, but I walked by and I said, "I'll get you." And anyway, about 3 or 4 weeks later, whatever it was, his girlfriend went on vacation or something somewhere without him, and he was there by himself. And so then I didn't say much to his name to him, and he didn't cut up as bad with her gone, but whenever she come back the next week, I walked over and I said, "Honey, I'm so glad you're back." I said, "That one he bought last week, the ugliest thing I ever seen." I never had any more trouble out of him. Yeah, Dublin's quite a place to go. Quite a place to go. We didn't stay at the same motel guys stayed at. And we stayed at another one down the road a ways. And anyway, Graham could lay on his back and float. He didn't sink. No part of his body didn't sink. He was like a balloon out there. And when we'd get to the town, he'd go get some beer, and he'd throw it in the pool, let it sink to the bottom. He'd lay out on that water, and once in a while, he'd throw a can over the fence to somebody's house, and they'd throw it. And they collected aluminum, they got wealthy off of it. He would dive down, come up with a beer in his hand, sit on his belly and drink it. We were drinking whiskey one day, and anyways, that's when busted my ankle up, and I've been poking in ice in the garbage can in there. But we had regular ice we was mixing the drinks with, but we run out. And I didn't realize, Graham said, I'll go in there and get the ice this time. He went in there, he come back with ice, and after we sit there and drinking, he said, "You know, you're out of ice." And I said, "Well, you had enough to fill these up, didn't you?" He said, "Yeah, I got it out of that garbage can."
Where was he living when he died?
I don't know if he was back in Arizona or if he was living, he was around L.A. for a while there. Towards the end of his life, because he was still working, you know, what was left of the Los Angeles territory out there. He would work every once in a while as a manager or something. And he was either there or maybe back in Arizona. I don't know.
Well, he was mental after his mother died. He went mental. He went, I'm afraid he's going to go postal there for a while. So they brought him back in. The man to me, and when I was there, I think it was. Anyway, when he got out, someone told me that he's gone nuts. And he gets out, comes running over there in Pensacola to me and seeing me and going to hug my neck. He had a suit coat on and everything. And he, all of a sudden, he just stopped and he said, "You want anybody wiped out?" I said, "Do what? You want anybody wiped out?" And he opened that coat up. He had knives, and clubs, and nunchucks, all kind of stuff. He said, "I can take care of it." And I thought, "Oh, yeah, here we go again." Then I went through a lot of stuff with him. You know, he done a lot of things.
Well, he was involved in probably the most famous riot as far as wrestling went, in I think it was 57, 58 or something like that. He and Dick the Bruiser working Edward Carpentier and Rocca. And they started a riot in Madison Square Garden that got written up for all across the country. It made national news.
Uh-huh.
Probably the most famous riot in the wrestling business. And he was right in the thick of it, him and Rocca.
Well, he was one of the hottest things he was around in the 50s.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'll tell you what, though, he had a good side, too. You know, a lot of them guys they brought in there that wasn't paying anything, and they were starving. So and he was making anywhere from $2,000 to $5,000 a week, which is a lot of money back then. And anyway, he'd go $100 bills. Nothing out, you know. So he had a good side, but you didn't see it very often.
Yeah, he was one of those that made a ton of money and then ended up with pretty much nothing.
you think of Don Fargo, how much money the Fargos made in New York.
Oh, yeah.
Fargo made money, I mean, all over the place. They were a big draw in Tennessee. Donnie was a big draw in Mobile by himself. And just unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah, Fargo, when Bill and I was working some deals up there in Tennessee territory, up around Huntsville and all, we wore that cowboy stuff, boots and belt and all that stuff. And anyway, we'd take the belts off and make comebacks with whipping them with them. The Fargo's hollering harder, harder, harder. Give me everything we got, and I think he was enjoying it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
He loves
anyway,
the work
still. Oh, yeah. I seen him and Frank at Birmingham TV one time. One of them had a mole or something on his neck. And he was smoking a big old cigar. And he says, man, I got this mole. He says, how did you get these things? He said, they burn them off. He said, burn them off? He said, yeah. He says, but take that cigar there and fire it up. And burn it off for me. And he did that. That's a big thing. You can smell it burning. That'd be anything. They do money. Now, we're talking about Jerry Graham. Jerry Graham comes one time up there in New York. He paid back in the 50s, $250 for a bottle of champagne. And I said, Grab mine. Now, how did you do that? He said, I always want to crap gold. Hey, gold in it. Hey, gold play. Michael, you might remember that steakhouse. It used to be on Governor Street. Out there close to where the golf course is.
Yeah, yeah. Close to the loop?
Yeah, close to the loop. But anyway, it's a big white building at Steakhouse. But ma'am, two different times, he got some money from somewhere. He had $10,000 in the glove box. We went in there, and he said, I'm going to take you boys in there and buy you a steak. So we went in there. He was going to buy us a steak. He bought everybody in the place one. You know, just the way it was.
Living the image.
Yeah, you have to get, when Bill gets better and he can get back on with us, you have to get Bill to tell the story. When we were working for Gunkel, and we were working, doing some stuff with Carlos Colon, they sent him to Puerto Rico, and he came in one night. He was staying at the El San Juan, and they had a hotel, or had a swimming pool in the hotel lobby. And he came in after making the trip or making the town. He came in and he jumped in the pool with his clothes on. And like Bill says, he could float like a duck. He stripped down naked and was floating around the pool. And they went across. Bill was staying across the street, and they went over and got Bill over to talk him out of the pool. And they said he got out and picked his suitcase up and walked up the steps toward his room butt naked.
Yeah.
Clothes just floating in the pool.
Well, you know, he went down in Florida, he went in this nightclub. I think I told y'all this story. With that Tarzan outfit on, and they started picking at him. He pulled a gun out and shot over the head and told him they don't want to act like dogs, get on the floor and crawl and bark like a dog. No, he made the newspaper with that. Went to Pensacola Airport, walked in there and ordered two of the biggest steaks he had and had with his Tarzan outfit on. And I started making fun of him, so he stood up on the table, beat his chest like Tarzan. And my name's Dr. Jerry Graham. Said, I'm the meanest MF in town. If you keep my ass, come home. And the newspaper headlines this time, give me the headlines. It says, roars like a tiger, sleeps like a lamb. They got him down to jail and went right to sleep. yeah. But he was a character.
Well, I only had the privilege of hauling his big butt one time. I had to bring him home from Athens.
Mm-hmm.
And Jerry's brother Ted was in the back seat, was in my car, and he was staying downtown at the that hotel, the Domino Lounge, was in on the first floor, Imperial Hotel.
Uh-huh.
And we pulled in the parking lot. He got out, and he started cussing and screaming. And there's a guy came out of the parking booth there and had a gun in each hand. And me and Ted like to have a double knockout diving in the floorboard. And the guy come out and seen him, said, "Oh, it's just you, you big fat SOB." He told him, I need some change. And I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't pay much attention to him. And he threw a $20 bill in the car and said, "Here's my trans." I said, "Man, you don't owe me that kind of money." He said, "Take it and go, kid." And I went, "See ya."
he was giving them $20 bills, man. He'd pull up in front of a restaurant or a nightclub, and he'd just park right at the front door. And they come out and say, "You can't park there." He just hand them $20 bills to park it for me. Just go right on in. The middle of the night, we went out with them Rising Suns over in Dothan, a nightclub. And he had them singing that Japanese song, "Ah Da Da." And I thought, never got that vindicated, Evan, you know. But them old guys just got back from Vietnam, and they were partying. And when they didn't stop singing because Graham hollered, "Sing it again." And they made some remark about they had enough of it or something. They told them to shut up. And they sat at our table. He must have had 75 drinks on that table, because that time she'd go by that he'd order them 10 more drinks. And we wasn't drinking a tenth of them. So he just picked them up in his hand like that. He looked around and seen how many of them it was. He started hitting to him, and they said, "What'd you say, fat man?" He started handing him drinks out. He said, "Sit down and have a drink and shut up." He wouldn't sit down.
Just in comparison, Jerry, what were the fans like in Japan?
They didn't react much. They just ooh and ah. I remember the first time I went, I thought I was doing something wrong. But they wasn't responsive like they were here. It was different, a lot different.
She'd ooh and ah, but now she says, "What the hell you want?"
Yeah, they were, you know, that was just them, you know.
Any of you guys ever work on Indian reservations? Because I've heard they're the same way.
Philadelphia.
Mississippi, the Indian reservation, Mississippi.
You work that good?
I don't know if it's the same one or not, Joe.
The Philadelphia, Mississippi. And then you get to going, they may, if you're just having a match, they may say a few things and look at you and stare. No, whenever they, you start getting some heat up, they throw them arms and all of them staring straight at you. You better hope we don't have Indian uprising.
I tell you what, the most dangerous fans I've ever seen was in Puerto Rico.
I didn't go there, but
did you go down there, Bobby?
No, never went.
Rocket said
they stood outside the entrance to the buildings and sold rocks for a dime apiece.
Yeah.
Oh, they were mad about the rocks.
I heard this story one time about this doctor was in there, and they're throwing the rocks up through this window. And everybody's so used to it, you know, they just duck and stay out of the way. And that doctor, he walked up to the started over the heads.
Don't do that. Don't do that. Don't do that. They're saving from it.
I was down there for a week and I never went back.
Yeah. You heard about Sputnik going, didn't you?
The what now?
Sputnik.
No.
You didn't come down there in some ball park or something. They had a bunch of dressing rooms. They went in this one dressing room and saved a few pieces. He thought it was too small, so he got out and went to another one. He got that another one, and when he just left, blew up.
I don't doubt it.
Yeah. Jared, did they have to escort y'all to the airport?
They had to escort us when we'd get to the matches into the building, and then when we'd leave, they had nightsticks. What got myself into?
Yeah. They had jeeps and machine guns when we get to the airport sometimes.
I don't doubt that either.
That's one reason I didn't go. You know, a lot of men take the stretch and come up and play them rocks and everything.
I know when Gunkel was running, they were sending guys down there, Bobby.
Ooh. Well, I would have went, you know, if I'd had the opportunity, but they never, you know, we wasn't swapping referees, so I never got a chance to go, but, I remember Ted telling me that there was a water shortage or something on the island. And I remember him telling me that the morning he came back, he went down and took a bath in the swimming pool. He said they cut the water off about dark and they wouldn't cut it back on till the next day. And I think he told me his plane left like at 6 o'clock in the morning or something, and he was so glad to get off that island. He went down there and got in the shallow end of the swimming pool with a bar of soap and took a bath.
That's pretty bad, eh?
Oh, that's wanting to go. Well, I tell you, you know, we talk about all these fans, and I'm pretty sure Joe worked there, and so did Jerry. I tell you, a place that was strange, and you never knew what you was going to get into was we used to go to Milledgeville. Asylum, the state mental asylum.
State mental.
Yeah.
I wanted to say nut house, but I was trying to be correct. So I mean, it was a strange
that
place.
Name? What was that man's name there, Bobby? That kind of would oversee the stuff.
I do
there.
Not know.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I met him. They had
he was always there.
Them people used to bake cakes and cook and stuff. You'd go in the dressing room and there'd be all kinds of stuff there, and nobody
they'd
ever
be there when I left.
Yeah, it was there when you left, too. Nobody would touch it.
The security there, I was talking to them one day. There was a couple of them over by that door, side door. And this real nice-looking lady come up there, well-spoken and everything. She came up and just talking to them. She might work with them. One day she finally she told them, one says, you know, I'm going home tomorrow. They said, oh, that's real nice. And then she walked in there, and I said, oh, she a patient? And she said, you going tomorrow? I said, great. I said, that's what you're going to wear. She whipped three of us last night.
Jeez. Yeah, they would put the women's prisoners from the state women's prison was always on the stage, and they had a guard at either end of the stage with a shotgun.
I never understood that.
That's one. That's where Bearcat Wright got down there in front of the stage. And he is aggravating them, hollering, what kind of bird can't fly? And Ed Dale's telling him, said, you bring your butt up here, we'll show you what kind of bird can't fly.
They probably would have, too.
Oh, yeah.
I never understood that.
Ooh.
Always, every time we talk about a prison or something like that, I always think about when we was at that federal penitentiary in Las Vegas. When the homemade knives go cutting. I remember that.
Joe, your phone's fading in and out real
quick. Yeah, I'm getting about every third word.
We're talking about Ox Baker at the Federal Penitentiary when we wrestled there.
Yeah.
And anyway, one of them prisoners would go cut him with a homemade knife. You remember that?
I wasn't out there when that happened. I heard about it, but I wasn't there.
Yeah. Anyway, we worked with Ox, and we reached up there. We had us down, and we reached up there and pulled his tights down. Bill did. We showed his butt. All in prisoners started hollering, "F him, F him." Not a place.
Well, Bobby, do you know what was the reasoning behind putting on those shows at the penitentiary?
I don't know the reason. I guess it was just a goodwill gesture, you know, as far as the wrestling office was concerned. I mean, they considered at the mental hospital, they considered it therapy. I ain't quite figured out what kind of therapy it was, but
yeah,
but I guess, you know, maybe that prison was the same kind of thing. It was just a goodwill bumper or another.
Because, I mean, they couldn't have made any money doing that because...
No, it was a donation
thing. They didn't charge those prisoners. Otherwise, your payoff would have been in cigarettes that night.
Yeah, we did it for free.
Yeah, it was gratis.
There's no way I'd have gone into a prison for free.
I like Tuscaloosa.
It's a eerie place, that federal pen up there, man.
It is. Talking about the nut houses, or whatever you want to call them, up in Tuscaloosa, we wrestled there, and it's on an open field. And it's on a bald park. And anyway, there was a girl went walking across there with hot pants on and, you know, real short shorts and a real small halter top. And she's walking across there, and the guy that worked there was sitting there taking care of us. And I said, "She must work there." He said, "No, sir, she's a patient." And I said, "Really?" And I said, "You mean something wrong with her mentally?" He said, "Of course it is." So I got out in the ring, and she walked out there and sat down at ringside. And that same guy done announcing, we up there, standing in the corner, and that girl started hopping top of her voice, "F me, F me, F me." And walked out that mouth. I said, "Oh, you tell me that girl was nuts."
There was it's just kind of a one of them. There was a guy that Freddie Miller used to run a spot show in Braselton, Georgia, every once in a while. This was a long time before Kim Basinger bought Braselton, Georgia, but there was a guy up there that was with the local JCs or something. He run the show up there, and he was kind of a goof. But Freddie always ran the day after Thanksgiving. He always run a town in South Georgia called Douglas, Georgia, and we always drew good houses there the day after Thanksgiving on that Friday night. And we were down there that night, and I was refereeing, and the main event was Abdullah and somebody. And I had this little deal I did with Abdullah where he would just beat the crap out of me and throw me through the ropes. And I'd go through the middle and the top rope, and I'd catch myself with my toes, and I'd hang upside down. And this guy from Braselton, how he wound up in Douglas, Georgia, I have no idea. But I'm hanging upside down by my toes. And he comes running up to the ring going, "I'll help you, I'll help you." And rather than grabbing me by the shoulders or something to try to ease me down that 2 foot I was off the floor, he reached up and undid my feet.
I get the rest of it from there.
Buddy, I was hotter than a depot stove. He dropped me right on my head. But that was, you know, there again. Good thing. Oh, I'm going to help you. Yeah, you. Thank you. I appreciate it. That may be what's wrong with me today. I don't know.
You never think about it again. Yeah.
Do what, Jerry?
I said it could have something to do with it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
Maybe think about Willie Garrett. He had that guy in Cleveland, Tennessee. That he's a young gay guy. And he liked Willie Garrett so much, and he'd go and Willie Garrett was, I think, for a joke, you know, he'd bring him in the dressing room, make him tie his shoes and treat him like he was a slave, all kind of stuff. And it all backfired on him when he started running around the ring and hopping, "Come on, Willie, come on, Willie." One week, he got out there and went around the ring hollering, "You better not hurt my Willie. I'm having his baby."
Oh, man. Well, see, Jay, you see what all you missed out by not being an ever-working heel? You could have been stabbed.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you got hit by a chair. I guess that counts. But,
yeah, that counts.
All except Union City, Tennessee. We worked here playing babyface everywhere else.
Well, Danny Hodge got cut almost as bad as Jack Donovan did when that fam came in on that match in Oklahoma. I can't imagine. But, yeah, I guess I can. I dreaded working places that sold beer. Because the more beer they drank, the more likely they were going to do something stupid.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Oh, man.
There, Fort Whiting, they threw beer up, a whole cup of beer from down up, and it went up my nose. I had no sinus trouble for 3 months.
Did we lose Joe? Still with us, Joe?
What?
I was checking to make sure you were still with us. It sounded like you dropped off.
Oh, okay. I'm here. I'm here.
Okay.
What's
that?
I'm going to plug this thing up and see if it knows you better.
I'll tell you something else about fans. We're talking about fans, and I can't tell you names of these people, but there was always and talking about them drinking, there was always the one drunk or the one fan that thought they were super tough. They were the ones that always tried to figure out how to get next to somebody because they wanted to be a wrestler.
Mm-hmm.
I know I've told y'all the story about the guy in Savannah. He was drunk as Cooter Brown, and he come up to Rocket. And told Rocket, he said, "I want to challenge you." And Rocket said, "Why do you want to challenge me?" He says, "Because I think I can whoop you." And Rocket said, "Well, you might be able to whoop me." He said, "But you beat me, you ain't really beat nobody." He said, "But you see that guy standing way over there?" He said, "That's Jack Briscoe." He said, "He's a world heavyweight champion." He said, "If you beat him, then you're the champion, then you are somebody." The guy said, "Okay." So the guy started out across the thing over there where Jack was. And we sitting over there watching, and it was probably 2 or 3 minutes of conversation back and forth. And finally, we seen the old drunk guy take about a step back, and he throwed both hands over his head like somebody had pulled a gun on him. Said, "Stick them up." And when they did, Jack hit him right between the eyes, and the guy went down and slid about 3 feet on his back, on his butt, and then he just laid over in the floor. And Jack went to the dressing room. So I proceeded to make my way over to the other side, and I asked Jack what happened. And Jack said, "Well, he wanted to challenge me," and I told him how he challenged me was to step back and throw his hands up. So,
idiot.
He hit him.
Well, the guy that was it in Columbus, the guy that bit Tim Woods' finger off, was he a regular?
Yeah. No.
He just showed up down there to challenge somebody?
He showed up at Columbus TV.
He's
bad, Joe. He was bad. His name was Arnold Sperling. He just showed up in Columbus,
ago, didn't he?
Yeah. Didn't he died probably 3 years ago. Oh, he whipped everybody.
Didn't that guy live in Phoenix, Alabama?
He lived in Phoenix City, yeah.
He was sitting at ringside.
I'll give him credit. He sold that auditorium out. Everybody in town knew who he was.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of those guys. They don't have guys around like that anymore. I mean, nobody in town would fool with him. I mean, he was bad, man. And Tim Woods got on TV, said nobody could unmask him, you know. He didn't mean Arnold. But Arnold showed up, live TV. He said, I'll take that mask over you. Anyhow, they put it off about 3 weeks. They finally did it. And they told Tim, they said, look, this guy's bad. He's dangerous. You know, he's crazy. He's this, he's that. And Tim was too nice a guy.
Yeah.
He was too nice a guy. Should have been somebody like Briscoe.
Ooh.
He'd beat his brains
out. Or Harley.
Yeah. Well, they warned him. They say he's dangerous. They say he's allowed to do anything.
Well, in Phoenix,
that
I heard he was infected with
completely food. Out.
You know, I used to go on in Phoenix years ago. I heard he belonged to that group from over there.
Who's that?
That guy that fought Tim Woods. He's from Phoenix City. And you know what went on over there years ago?
He was too young for that. He was too young for that.
Really? But Tim
was,
told me.
Yeah, he wasn't. He wouldn't have been any part of that.
Yeah?
No. No, they would kill you then. He was just a fighter. I know when I was in high school, we'd be out of McDonald's, he'd pull in, we'd crank up and leave.
Mm-hmm.
He was an idiot. He was an absolute idiot.
Yeah. Oh, Tim, one time when everybody was getting CBs, he was stalling them in their cars. And he was putting them on the mount above the hump in the front of the seat. And he'd drill a hole and mount the thing and put the CBs in there for him. One of the guys wanted him to do it, and so Tim said, yeah, I can do it. He drilled a hole all the way in through his transmission.
Tim was a good guy, man.
He sure was.
He was a great guy.
Yeah. He had a good personality. He didn't get mad at people real easy or anything.
And if you refereed his matches, you got beat to death.
Yep.
Did you?
He was clumsy. God, he was clumsy. One of the funniest things that you had to talk to him, get him to tell you the story. Of course, he can't tell you now, but he would tell the story. They worked the deal in Atlanta where they had John turn heel, and they were working against each other. And when John threw that knee lift, you know, it was to say it was snug is putting it mildly.
Yeah, very
and
much.
But he would come at you head on, and what you did, you just kept your head turned away from the knee, and he come at Timmy one night, and Timmy turned his head and looked at the knee, and John hit him, and it blackened both his eyes. He looked like a raccoon. I mean, he liked killed him.
Yeah, that knee was no joke.
No, sir.
No, sir.
You didn't have any problem settling it. I talked to John last week. He is actually
in
Atlanta. He was in Charlotte, then he came down to Atlanta. He's been here since last Tuesday, I guess, is when I talked to him the first time, and I talked to him again Saturday. He is going back home tomorrow, but he said tell everybody hello. Did he call you, Jerry?
No, I didn't hear from him.
I gave him your phone number. I normally don't give out people's numbers, but I didn't figure you'd mind him having it.
No.
And
no,
I gave it to him, but he's getting a little forgetful, I think. And but he seems to be doing well, and he said his health's coming back, and he sounded good. He just
that's good.
He said, "Tell everybody hello."
He was a friend. Johnny was a friend.
Yep.
There's somebody when you, I don't know what the time difference is between here and in Hawaii, but that's somebody we need to try and get on the show.
About 9 hours.
About six. I thought it was six. It may be nine.
So it'd be noon. 11 o'clock in the morning, and we try and get him. Next time you talk to him, Bobby, why don't you try and line that up for us?
All right.
See what his schedule allows. He'd be a fun one to talk to. I know what you mean about that knee. I had no feeling on the side of my face for a week after I worked with him. I didn't do my head right, evidently, because he nailed me. Ooh. I don't know what was worse, him with that or Hansel with that lariat that he threw. Of course, you control what
that wasn't no deal
either.
That wasn't
all he
no
did
either.
Was stick his arm out.
Well, he couldn't see either.
No. He or Bob Armstrong.
Well, you know, you're talking about, we talked about all them different kind of gimmick matches. We never talked about the first Braille match I was ever in. Tom Ernesto against Bob Armstrong. It was by feel.
And somebody told me Ernesto one time that whoever he's working with, they call a high spot. And one of it was where he drops down and gets up and they could do something else. Ernesto dropped down and he didn't get back up. And the guy from dressing, why did you get back up? He says, "Man, I don't know where you're coming from." He says, "I got to know where you're going to be at. I don't have my glasses on."
Axel Duggan was another one that was that way. He was not only blind without his glasses, he was cross-eyed, so you never knew which direction
yeah.
he was coming.
Yeah, he saw three of you.
Make that swing broad enough so he makes sure he makes contact with one of them.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, Stan's lariat, that was one of them deals where you prayed your chin was high enough to get under it.
Yeah, that was no joke.
Well, he would tell you. He said, "I'm going to stick it out to you. It's up to you as to how hard it hits you."
Jeez. But that's another guy that was so totally opposite his persona.
Oh, absolutely.
He was soft-spoken, nice guy.
He's a great guy.
Never a cuss word out of his mouth. He just was a pleasure to be around.
That's why Lou the Lindsay was. Luther Lindsay, he give you that shot to the throat. If you didn't have an album's apple, you'll have one when he gets to hit you.
Well, we've mentioned Rocket several times. Rocket wasn't fun either with that little short punch of his. He'd have you in a headlock and either punch you or he'd do that thumb to the throat, and that was usually pretty stiff too. Rocket's working punch was like getting hit with a brick.
He was solid, man.
Like working with a fire plug. The funniest line I ever heard anybody give Rocket had to be Jody Hamilton when they were working him and Flash was working against Tom and Jody, and they got through with a match in Griffin one night, and Rocket went back and he said, "Man, that was great. Did you think it was good? You think it was good?" And Jody looked at him and said, "I've had easier street fights."
Oh. Old Rocket was good at pulling ribs too, wasn't he?
Yes, he was.
Especially on Flash.
Oh, God.
I don't know how the two of them stayed together as long as they did.
Right,
he tormented it. That poor guy.
Yeah.
My introduction to them ribbing each other was, I was probably 14, 15, and Flash lived two doors down from Rocket. And they lived over there at Caesar's Palace Apartments there in Hapeville. And we was out to, I was at Rockets, and Flash came over early that morning, and he said, I'm going to take my car down here to this mechanic. He said, I found this mechanic. He's great. He does great work. He's going to tune my car up. So he went down there and tuned the car up. And when he come back up there, he went in the house. Well, as soon as he went in the house, Rocket went out there and took a potato and shoved it up the exhaust pipe. And, of course, when the car couldn't breathe, it run like a beat-up sewing machine. And he took that thing back down there, and he's raising Cain at this kind of guy. Said, look, man, somebody shoved a potato up your tailpipe. And of course, he come back up there, and Rocket denied it, of course. But that was my introduction to Rocket's ribbon Flash. And then the next one was when he put the X. Well, now that was the time he did it in Georgia. The worst, I guess, was when he did it in Mobile, when he put that, he poured that X-Lax on them chocolate cookies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He at the matches, he stayed on the toilet the whole time at Fort Whiting.
Oh.
Well, the best Rocket part about that is Rocket told him they were going to wear the yellow gimmick or yellow outfits that night.
Rocket told me McGuire came up to him and told him, he said, I don't know what you've done this time, but you've about killed him.
And Rocket jumped the top rope, and then, because knowing Flash, you try and do it too, when Flash gets to Maddie, he sold his pants.
Oh, yeah. So, he told me, you know, when Rocket told me the story, he said I didn't intend for Flash to eat all of them. Somebody was managing them at the time.
Ken Ramey was.
It was right. Okay, and he said when they rode together, he said Doris, his wife, had fixed him something to eat, and he said it didn't matter what it was. He said Flash and Ramey would just reach up there and start eating it. You know, it didn't matter. And so he made the cookies. He melted a big, large box of X-Lax on the stove and poured it over some chocolate cookies. And he said he intended for Ramey to eat half of them and Flash to eat half. And whatever reason, Ramey didn't ride with them that night. So Flash ate all of them, and that's what led to that.
That would lead to that, yes.
Oof.
And then they kept on even after they weren't teaming together. Flash had pretty much retired. He was doing, you know, he worked every once in a while, but he was working selling mobile homes, and he was had that scooter or bicycle or whatever it was on Pensacola Bridge, selling stuff, food and stuff out of it. And Rocket convinced this guy to go pretend to be actually been somebody that worked for the county of food.
No, he wasn't. He was just some guy Rocket knew.
Rocket said he'd never seen a fat man pedal a bicycle so fast in all his life. That guy went up there and told him he was a food inspector.
Yeah, wanted to see his license.
He's gullible, Flash was. He's easy to read.
Rocket said they were somewhere else one night, and I think they were in Mississippi somewhere. And Rocket said he went to the sporting goods store and he bought a can of that aerosol athletic bomb, you know, that like Bengay in a can.
Mm-hmm.
And he just saturated Flash's tights with it. And he said, you know, of course, they got out in the ring, got to sweating. He said, poor Flashlight to died.
I've got me another partner. I keep my stuff locked up. I don't eat nothing.
I've done something similar to that. You know that you've heard of the oil of mustard?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
In the Crestview, Florida, in the Indian, you know how we had them under tights? It's kind of like bikini tights.
Yeah.
He had them on, and he'd go out there and talk to the girls outside of the dressing room. And so we was in the National Guard Army there, and they had somebody still play dressing with the cars and doors. He'll be working the best. So anyway, while he's out there talking to girls, I went and put all the mustard around the rim of the tight down the leg. And so whenever they rung the bell for us, but he's still talking to girls, we wouldn't got in the ring. And they kept ringing the bells. Finally, he realized he was supposed to go out there. And he ran, jumped in them tights, and come out there, and he's standing over in the corner. And, you know, and he started sweating. And all of a sudden that stuff hit him. He done the damnedest Indian dance you ever seen in your life.
Isn't that the stuff when Jody was on the show? Didn't Jody say he got somebody to the gas station with that?
Him and Tom did it. They put it in a water gun. and they pulled in a gas station. The guy used to sit on the front row in Atlanta and was harassing them all the time. And they pulled in a gas station, and the guy, you know, they knew who he was, but they didn't know who they were because they were dressed up in suits. They were going somewhere, and said they told the guy something was wrong with the car. And every time the guy bent over in the car to look at it, they were hitting him in the butt with this mustard oil. And they said finally, when it hit him, they said as they drove off, they were watching in the rearview mirror and said the guy sit down and. You remember them when they used to fix flats at a gas station? They had to look like a half a tire. It was metal, and they'd fill it up with water. He said no boy was sitting in that when they pulled off.
That's what
you get. Yeah, where can you buy oil of mustard?
Drugstore. Jerry Graham introduced us to it, and because we was having so much trouble getting out of Fort Whiting. And matches over, people would wait around out there, and they'd surround you with rocks and sticks and everything else. So next day, we went and bought a big old, like an ear syringe thing, and it's a big one. And so I said, what are you going to do with that, Graham? He said, you'll see. We got back to Mobile that next week. He took it in there, and he put alcohol and oil of mustard together and sucked it up in there. We left out of there. There must have been 15, 20 people surrounded us with sticks and all. And they started getting closer and closer. They just pulled that thing out and started smiling and started spraying them. And that stopped them messing with us. It worked.
There was a guy in Atlanta. A fan, and he would sit just to the left of the stairs that went up on the stage there. And the guys started getting these blisters on their sides and on the back and on the small of their backs. And we couldn't figure out what it was. And man, I was washing all the mats and sanitizing everything, you know, thinking it was something on the mats or whatever. And we caught this guy finally. He'd sit out there and he had a water gun full of that stuff. And he'd fold his arms where that water gun was under his arms, and you couldn't see it. And when the heels had come by, he was squirting them with it. He had hit them with it. I mean, it was happening so fast, you couldn't see it.
Yeah. Man. Yeah, that stuff will burn you now.
Ooh.
It'll burn you. I didn't think if you got it in your eyes, what would happen.
Oh, man.
Yeah. It had to be rough if he got in the eyes.
There was a. I asked Bockwinkle about this in Las Vegas this year, if he remembered this, and he said vaguely. But I can remember as a kid going to the matches when Bockwinkle was healing here, and he was in the ring in Atlanta one night, and they stopped the matches. Some fan was shooting straight pins through a straw, like a blowgun.
Hmm.
And they hit him in the back a couple of times.
Hmm.
I mean, you know, it's just people. People don't, you know, they don't think past their nose.
Yeah. You know, I was going to tell y'all a story a while ago about Tuscaloosa, but I couldn't think of the racer's name, but now I know it's Ronaldo. I don't know if y'all remember him or not.
Rick Ronaldo?
Yeah. But anyway, in Tuscaloosa, yeah, we had one boy come to matches every week, sit ringside. And when you get in the ring or out of the ring, if he was mad at you, he would get toe-to-toe and nose-to-nose with you and start hollering and screaming. His mouth open more than it was shut. So one Ronaldo went out there, and he got in front of his face when he was trying to get out of the ring, and he couldn't get past him. And he started running his mouth wide open, and Ronaldo just got big old lugger and spit it in his mouth. I don't know if that boy ever quit spitting yet.
Well, the dumbest thing I ever saw a fan do, I've seen two, and they were pretty much tied. I saw a guy put a cigarette out on David Schultz's back, and that's just not somebody that you wanted to fool with, was David Schultz. And I saw another guy in Birmingham stand up on a chair and jump onto Saito's back as Saito was going back to the dressing room. Saito just went down to the floor, and next thing you know, this guy's feet are straight up in the air. He done suplexed him, laying him flat on the floor. That's another one I would not have thought a bit about messing with. Was Saito. He was a nice guy, but you could just look at him and tell he was dangerous. But
I didn't realize what all we did actually go through. They just baby face or a heel. Trying to get so much to it.
Yeah, people were, like Bobby's always said, that, you know, they were sure it was not real until they got into the heat of it, and then they were ready to fight.
Yeah.
Worst one I guess I ever seen was the guy jumped in the ring on Jody that night. In Atlanta, that was sad. He didn't try to hit Jody; he tried to tackle him, and that would be like trying to tackle a fire plug. And when Jody got through with him, the guy's eye was laying out on his cheek when they drug him out of the ring. It was it was a bad situation.
Yeah. You know, I always said, don't play, no matter what you do in life, don't play anybody else's game.
Oh, no.
You can't.
No. Yeah. Good advice.
Yeah. It was I just always felt that way. It's like you're in a bar, somebody come up with some trick. I bet you I can do this. And I said, I bet you can too. they want to bet so you can take your money. And one of the best people in the world for doing that too was Ken Lucas' partner. When his brother, Chris Lucas.
Yeah, Paul Christie.
Yeah, that joker was so good with tricks, it was unbelievable.
Well, he was a magician. He did all kinds. He's done all kind of stuff, magic tricks and stuff.
Yep. He's a good guy, though. He's a good guy, but he'd hustle you. Well, my computer's been off. My computer's been off for 45 minutes, and it just come back on all by itself.
I think it's time for you to buy a new computer, Jeff.
This one ain't too old. My daddy had it, but he didn't use it. You know, he had it for 3 or 4 years. I got it down here.
I believe him. Hey, let me tell y'all a little joke. This old couple laid in bed, and he reaches over and he pats her on the leg and all around her feet, up on the rear end, and then pats her arm and chest and everything. And finally, he just quit doing it. And she said, "What'd you quit for?" He said, "I found the remote."
Well, on that note, guys, I think I'm going to wrap it up for this evening. Joe, appreciate you joining us. And everything will, let's see, next week, for the next 2 weeks, I'm good, but the third Thursday, the 5th, I'll either be traveling or I'll have the show still. So I'm not sure. They were talking about adding a third show here, but I have not heard anything officially. Either that or I'll be traveling. Don't know where I'm going next, but hopefully it's South Georgia or South Alabama or the Gulf Coast somewhere, because I've got some legal things I'm trying to get taken care of, too, while I'm down that way. But I'll be closer. I can keep an eye on Bill and Roberto and all the troublemakers down that way.
Are you y'all going to Tennessee in September?
What's that?
Any of y'all going to Tennessee in September?
No, I'm not, because I'll still be working. I'll be here until
I am.
Are you? Good.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. We're leaving. We're going to leave that Thursday, which I think is the 24th, maybe the 25th. We'll be up that Thursday.
Good. Well, I'll see you up there. Ken Lucas is going to ride with me.
Good. Good.
He really enjoyed it.
Good. I'm glad Ken's going.
Good.
Hopefully Dennis Hall will be well enough to go. I haven't heard any more on Dennis. Have you, Bobby?
No, haven't heard another word.
Yeah.
Haven't heard another word.
Well, guys, I enjoyed it as always, and we'll get together again next week and see what kind of trouble we can get into. Joe, thanks for joining us. Bobby, Jerry, as always, it's been my pleasure sharing the airspace with you, and we'll get together next week and we'll do it again.
Sounds good. Good night, guys.
Good night.
Good night, guys. Good night, guys. Good talking to you.
All right.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, and more. As always, GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com thanks you for your continued support.